Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 11th of May. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
I'm Charles Archer.
How is everyone? Enjoying this fantastic weather. Kev's a little bit under the weather, but we're kind of over the weather. But how's everyone doing?
Oh, it's just boiling hot every single day, you know? Just go to the beach, have a barbecue, go to the beach, have a barbecue, write an article, go to the beach, and then just, you know, wait for the inevitable rain to come, and then we can all start working hard again. But it's just, it doesn't seem to be happening at the moment.
What's the rain? Well, is it not normally selling may go away, Charles?
Selling may go away. I think it's all kind of nonsense, isn't it? It's the same as sort of like the Halloween, the October effect, you know, and like the Santa rally and all of this. I think basically the selling may go away. It kind of makes sense because a lot of people do literally sell in May and then go enjoy the summer holidays and come back in September. But I don't know. I mean, for individual investment cases, it doesn't really make much sense. But I guess people do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any evidence that worked?
I don't know. From past experience of the markets, I've definitely seen a lull in trading volumes from May through. And they say, don't they, is it selling May, go away, come back St. Ledger's Day. And I think St. Ledger's is around the second week in September. I think Ledger's Day, roughly that, in middle of Sept.
Yeah.
But I think that there definitely is something in that markets do tend to decline. And have a look historically. You probably got the figures, but there's definitely less volume from memory. Mm. Kev, how are you feeling out there in Egypt, mate? How's things?
Yeah, I caught a cough and a cold from the kids. They all had it, and now I've got it. So, yeah, feel top of the morning, or maybe bottom of the morning. I'm not sure which way. But, yeah, the weather is normal here, 30 degrees and not a cloud in the sky. But, yeah, that's pretty normal. I was supposed to be going to the Mediterranean today, actually. We're recording this on Friday. But because of feeling crap, not bothered, because we're coming to England next week. So, you know.
Yeah. Get yourself better, yeah. So if I said the phrase Habemus Papam, what would I be declaring?
It would either be Harry Potter or there's a new Pope.
I like that. I do like that. It's a bit Hogwarty, but yeah, it's Latin for we have a Pope. I mean, obviously, we saw the news on Thursday. Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost of Chicago was elected as Pope Leo XIV, becoming the first American-born pontiff. His election follows the death of Pope Francis in April at the age of 88. We saw him obviously step out onto the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica. Pope Leo greeted the world with the words, "Peace be with all of you," signalling a message of unity and renewal. Known for his missionary work in Peru and recent role overseeing global bishop appointments, Leo XIV has taken inspiration from Pope Leo XIII, a champion of social justice, with challenges ahead from internal reform to global diplomacy. His papacy begins with hope and a clear nod to compassionate leadership. So, what do you make of that? I mean, Trump's message that he, I don't know if you saw that he put on Truth Social, the picture of himself dressed as the Pope, and then later said, well, I don't remember doing that, and denied all evidence. But do you think he's buzzing on that now, Pope, the fact that there's an American-born, you know, elected Pope in there?
I think it's quite interesting because he's on Twitter being very negative about Trump's policies, you know, and Jim Barnes. So it's kind of an interesting candidate. It's almost... You know, you don't want to think that popes are selected for short-term political reasons, and yet obviously the politics are part of it. If you picked an American pope who is trying to, you know, potentially use soft power to maybe get Trump to back off from starting, you know, international incidents, I don't know. I mean, possibly, but I think, you know, the first American pope is historic, and, you know, whether you're Catholic or not, you've got billions of individuals who listen to his opinion. So,
yeah. J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance is a devout Catholic, and basically this new Pope absolutely took him to the cleaners on social media, I think, in terms of his policies and stuff that he's done, and using the Bible to justify his plans or the plans of the Trump administration. So I think the fact that he's American, he was born in America. He's been a missionary in Peru in South America for many decades, I think. And then I think Pope Francis brought him back for this very reason. I really do think it's been sort of aligned, if you like, that Pope Francis put a lot of new bishops in there and that were younger or more the way he was thinking. So it's not a big surprise for me that that's it. The fact that he's American, he is American, but I think that's the least important issue of what what he is. It's as he said, I think on the balcony, it's all about peace. He wants peace in the world and peace to each other and to human beings. So yeah, hopefully he's going to work on the world as a whole and try and help people be less likely to kill each other.
I think the one thing I will say is that he it feels to me like he's going to be more vocal with his opinions, at least politically, than the last Pope was. I mean, I guess we'll see what that means or whether he changes. But having spent the past, I don't know, what, he's 69, 70? He spent
69,
70 years having opinions. It's very hard to switch those opinions off. I mean,
yeah.
I think in particular, like, the crux point for him is going to be, asylum slash illegal migration, not just in America, but across the West, and how that is dealt with as a problem. How does the Catholic Church approach that versus the practical realities of dealing with it? I think that's gonna be a firestorm over the next 5 or 10 years.
It'll be interesting to see whether he pulls back from social media because, as you say, as Kev just said, he was pretty vocal against Vance in February regarding some statements that Vance made about community and everything. So it'd be interesting to see whether or not he takes a step back now from that, or whether there's an official. I assume the Pope, like the Trump, has an official, or the Catholic Church, the head of the church, does have some sort of say on social media on X accounts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think to me, it's almost the same as the royal family in the UK, in that our current king was very vocal about, maybe not firebrand politics or partisan politics, but sort of very vocal about environmental politics, for example, or green politics, or young people. And now he doesn't vocalize those things anymore because he's the king. Is it the case that the Pope is going to change, this new Pope, is he going to change the way he is? I don't know, but then is that sort of a coward's way out? The Pope should be the leader and actually have opinions. I don't know. I don't know. I guess we'll see.
The interesting thing that I was reading when I was reading about who they were talking about appointing as the new pope was that the Catholic Church has got a few financial problems. The annual budget, if you like, or the annual money that they just naturally spend is way more than is what is actually coming in.
83 million euro deficit in 2023, so they've got a big financial problem.
Yeah. Now, why? Because of all the different scandals that occurred, especially the sexual scandals, has stopped people putting as much money into the church,
Declining
So
donations as well, Kevin, and pension fund liabilities,
that's
apparently.
what I mean, that declining donations, pension fund liabilities, it's a big organization. I think people forget that it's, it's not just the Catholic Church,
No, it's
it's a
money.
worldwide,
But the Vatican Bank announced
business effectively.
30 million euro net profits in. I didn't know there was a Vatican Bank, but that you learn something new every day. There
Yeah,
is.
but I think it's worth bearing in mind is that when they say profit, I mean, a lot of their operations are non-profit. So, do you know how much actual profit did they make that's not declared a profit because it's a non-profit? If you've got a local shop that operates as a non-profit and makes 100 grand in profit a year, but it says it's not profit, it's going to reinvest it back into the shop. But I think, saying that the Catholic Church has, financial issues, how much land does it own? How many trillions of dollars worth of assets does it
It
have?
doesn't actually have financial issues.
No.
It has a cash flow problem, I think, is the reality of the situation. The Catholic Church owns a lot of land in Israel as well. A lot of the land there was sectioned up because I had some friends there that were looking at getting land, but you can't buy it. You can rent it from the Catholic Church, but you cannot buy it. And they will not sell it. So, yeah. A very, very interesting times anyway, and yeah, we'll
Okay.
see
Well,
how it all goes.
talking of land and reopening and a specific area, did you see the announcement that Trump proposed the reopening of Alcatraz? I mean,
Ah,
as a
yes.
federal prison for the most ruthless offenders. Obviously, it sparked a lot of controversy due to the significant renovations which would be required. The fact that the island is effectively a national park and a museum piece, which I visited, and I'm sure probably both of you or one of you has visited as well. What do we make of that? The fact that, they would have to do significant investment and renovation. It's obviously everything needs to be ferried there in and out. And I mean, it's just mind-boggling that he wants to reopen it.
Does he want to, or is it his flavor of the day and he'll change his mind? Does he want to build a casino on it, really, after the presidency? No, all the groundworks are done. I think,
I think
go
it's
on,
just
Chris.
absolute crap. It's never going to happen. And he's just like, I don't know, he's trumping everything up, literally. So it's like, we are serious about The rule of law. Okay, what can we think about that will make a big splash? Right, we'll open Alcatraz again. It's like bananas.
Okay, like yesterday after, the UK-US deal, which is not actually a deal, is a few lines of text with months of negotiations ahead and then months of getting it through Congress.
Yeah.
But the market doesn't care about that because Trump, this is a direct quote from him yesterday, "You better go out and buy stock now. The economy will be like a rocket ship that goes straight up."
Wow.
How can you operate in a market like he's treating the S&P 500 like a meme coin?
Trump and dump, as you say.
It's Trump and dump. And the problem is, okay, it's rising, it's rising, it's currently rising, rising, rising. But or the fundamentals behind the US economy are struggling already. And even if the Chinese negotiations, say the tariffs in China between China and the US go to 50%, it's still in a much worse position than it was a couple of months ago.
Exactly.
So we just have a market that's completely detached from fundamentals. And the
Yeah.
bottom will fall out of it eventually, but who knows how long the music will go on.
Yeah, let's just unpack that because that, as you say, it wins the global race. UK wins the global race to shake off the worst Trump trade tariffs. We saw on Thursday the US slashing the tariffs on UK cars from 27.5% to 10%, but that was only for a quota of, I believe, 100,000 vehicles annually. Now that immediately is fraught with what do you say? Okay, so the first 100,000, does that, is that just one manufacturer who happens to say Jaguar ships the first 100? You know what I mean? Like, how do you manage who
I
gets?
think
Last year we only shipped 101,000 cars
exactly.
anyway, so
So it doesn't
that's
matter. Basically, what it's doing, it's saying you can continue to ship that many cars, but you can't grow the industry into the US.
it's
I think the
capping
more,
what is already a ceiling effect. Yeah.
I mean, for me, the more interesting question, obviously, there's questions about food quality. Trump was actually suggesting that US food standards would come to match UK food standards and get rid of chlorinated chicken, which would be
Yes.
quite interesting.
Yeah, the US beef one was interesting, wasn't it? But that was access to, was it 13,000 tons of beef quota again? I mean, what it'd be interesting to know what was actually exported from the,
Well, it virtually nothing because for example, when we allow New Zealand lamb to come into the UK, and I grew up in a farming family, and we do lambs, New Zealand can grow lambs much cheaper than we can, even including the shipping costs. The US beef is a lot more expensive to produce than in the UK already, so we're not going to buy it regardless of whether they can sell it into our market because our beef is cheaper. It's as simple as that.
Our beef is probably cheaper and less prone to using the chemicals or antibiotics
Yeah,
or
far
enhanced
higher
that.
quality.
I mean, they put all sorts of growth hormones into
Yeah, of
most of
course
the
they do.
animals that they have. I mean, have you ever seen a chicken breast in America?
Yeah,
Oh my word.
they're
It's
just.
like the whole chicken here. One
Because they
chicken
pump
breast
them
is
full of
like the
chlorine and
whole
water,
chicken.
and I mean, they're like super chickens, aren't they, over there?
Yeah, mutated chicken. And ours are bad
Mutation.
enough as well. Don't pretend that ours are great,
Oh
but they're
yeah,
better.
absolutely. I mean,
No,
but if you ever buy them frozen in America and then defrost them, that's quite
the water
comical
that just
actually, because
goes
you just see
everywhere.
them go
Flood, floods your kitchen.
reduced.
So,
Yeah,
did you see the
unbelievable.
reduction in the steel and aluminium tariffs to zero? Because that's obviously potentially going to save thousands of jobs in the British automotive and steel industries at a time
Well,
when the steel industry is absolutely strangled, as we saw in Wales.
It's almost like when you take out a fixed rate on your mortgage and you're kind of gambling that when you take out a fixed rate, you're gambling that that you're going to get a better deal than just waiting on a variable tariff. It kind of feels like that, but on a much grander scale, because tariff situation is now worse for the UK than it was a couple of months ago, but better than it was 2 days ago.
Sure.
So by going first and saying, right, we're going to go with this deal, it's worse than it was before, but at least it keeps trade open and it's better.
Okay.
Is that then better having gone first, or would it be better to wait and let Trump cave? Or is it the case we're going to have a better trade deal than Europe, for example, than the
Well,
EU?
that's what I was going to ask you because I don't know if you saw, obviously, there was also another deal finalized this week with the UK and India, a free trade agreement, which was took up. There's like 3 years of negotiation. So this was well before any Trump tariff stuff. So I want to ask you, being at in, is this one of the benefits we're seeing of Brexit? The fact that we can go directly to these countries like India and negotiate our own free trade agreements. We've done it with the US. We've got a better deal than the EU have. I mean, if you look at this trade deal, it's expected to boost the economy by like £4.8 billion by 2040. And you know, they've lost control of the narrative. I know Labour have, but there's been a lot of criticism allowing Indian workers to avoid paying this UK national insurance for, I think it's 3 years that he said, which there's been a lot of attacks from the right saying it's again two tier Keir. But what are your thoughts on that? Do have we been able to negotiate a better deal because of Brexit?
We can negotiate a faster deal. I think that's the most important thing. If you're in the European Union, you can probably negotiate a better deal because you have a much larger market. However, you're going to take years and years to do it because you've got to get 26, 27 countries to agree. And if one country disagrees, then you're back to the drawing board, depending on the framework that you're using. If you're one country, then you can just make your deal and then go for it. In kind of the same way, imagine there was 27 of us in the Sunday roast and we all decided to do a podcast. What company should we talk about? It's kind of hard to get 27 people to agree. Three people you can agree, and one person can just decide what they want. With the India deal, and specifically with national insurance contributions, we have similar deals on national insurance for temporary workers with several countries all over the world, and it's never really been a problem because the company hiring that Indian worker in the UK, yes, that employee isn't paying national insurance in the UK, but they are paying the equivalent rate in India. To India so they can get their pension in India. In the same way as, if I go work abroad, I won't have to pay social security contributions in both the UK and the country I'm working in, just back in the UK, generally when you have a trade arrangement. So I think that when it was first reported, a lot of people jumped on the bandwagon and thought, oh, this is, a really awful deal, when actually it's just, a pretty standard trade deal term.
Process. It's just it's incompetent journalism ultimately, because they're not giving you the whole story. They're giving you the story
Sensationalism.
that, that's gonna get the thing. I mean, the question I would pose is, if we look 10 to 15 years down the line, you said 2040, is it gonna be, we're gonna look back on this week and say, was it more important that the UK did a deal with 1.3 billion people in India, or 300 million, 350 million people in the US? Which
So I've got, so yeah, that's exactly what I've got
deal
in my notes. Yeah,
is
the
going to be
deal.
more important to the
So
UK?
India, do you know where they are currently on a global economy scale? What number they sit at now?
Three, maybe
Now they're number five, right, on the global
five.
scale. Now they are predicted to move to three by 2028, surpassing Germany and Japan, right? So that if you look at the top six or the top five, you've got US, China, India, that's obviously if they move up. Germany, Japan, and the UK. So five out of those six are already outside of the EU. So it brings back to Kev's point. Would you rather do a deal with the US? All right, they're at the top with 300 million, but the potential for India's growth is phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is a lot of the American GDP growth is based on these kind of large giant tech stocks. And obviously, they do have a, the Magnificent Seven, massive dominance in their respective markets. But that doesn't mean it will stay forever, And yeah, especially if the US dollar dominance starts to go down. I will say on the India deal, though, that whether it's a coincidence or not, it's the fact that we signed the deal and then, the same day, a few hours later, you've got India and Pakistan potentially at war with each other. That kind of timing is a bit suspect. Would you agree?
It's not looking good.
I don't know. I don't know that. I think it's more coincidental than anything else, but you never know, do you? You never know how these things work in the corridors of power.
Power.
But I mean, I see the top two economies in the world probably by 2050 are probably going to be China and India. Almost certain, just by sheer weight of numbers. You're going to have 2.6 to 2.8 billion people, which is what, a third of the planet, in
Yeah, I
two economies.
the
Now,
problem.
the US, if you go back 20 years, this Magnificent Seven didn't even exist to a large degree. If you go back, well, let's say go back to 2000, how many of the Magnificent Seven, the companies actually existed?
You'd have Apple, Microsoft, NVIDIA wouldn't be around. I'm trying to think how many.
When did Google begin? It was around that time,
Google would
wasn't
have
it?
been, yeah, around that
Yeah.
time, but they wouldn't
They're
certainly
all
wouldn't.
dot-com stocks that won in the bub when the bubble crashed. As simple as that, really. But
Yeah, except for Microsoft, not Microsoft. Facebook didn't come until after 2000.
after, wasn't it? Yeah.
Meta wouldn't have been around, but certainly
Meta
NVIDIA.
wouldn't. Nvidia, was Nvidia around before
Yeah, but
2000?
it's just a gaming chip company, like it wasn't anything
It was just
special.
producing graphic cards, wouldn't it? All the
Yeah,
big.
like you just picked an NVIDIA or an AMD chip. And Nvidia is just taking the storm, obviously, but like it.
So the point I'm trying to make is, like, 25 years ago, they really didn't mean much. Now they seem to mean everything to everybody. Where are they going to be in 25 years' time? There's no way they can have as epic growth story as they've just had for 25 years, isn't it? It's not possible because, they'd be taking over the world, literally,
Well,
doing
betting
all this
against
stuff.
America. I mean, I am currently, but who knows how long for. However, I will say India's demographics are very well set up for growth, even with its massive population. It's got a very strong birth rate. China, with that one child policy, even if they've reversed it now, they've destroyed themselves demographically. So when you're talking like longer term, 30, 40 years, they're getting stronger and stronger and stronger. What happens to their economy when you've got four grandparents and two parents being supported by one child financially? I suspect that's going to be a big problem, especially because 40% of China's GDP is based on the real estate sector. So if that real estate sector crashes, then all of the family wealth disappears. I'm not going to say bet against China because that's generally a bad idea as well. But demographically, it's even more problematic. If you look at what's going on in South Korea or Japan, it's even more problematic than those two. It's just behind them. They're just
And the
not having
thing
any
is with
children.
India, Charles, is that the middle class are increasing all the time. I think they say 31% of the current population is middle class, which is defined as earning like $6,000 to $8,000 or something a year. But that's predicted to grow to like 47% by 2030. So all the time, the wealth is there,
Growing
being
in India and it's
growing
falling in
massively.
China, I think. But yeah, and I think this brings us back, to the immigration question is if you don't have enough children, do you know how much immigration do you accept? How much is acceptable to, local populations? Can they integrate? If you don't have any immigration at all, then economies collapse. And that includes the UK and the US and Italy and South Korea and Japan and China. But if you do too much, then you put more pressure on that, you actually generate more pressure on services and the migration improves.
Musk was big on this, wasn't he? Musk was basically saying the biggest challenge to the world is actually population
Yeah, it is.
implosion. The fact that, I mean, if you want to look at a country that has good fundamental economic forward-looking abilities, if you like, you need a youngish population with not too many old people at this stage, and India hits that. I mean, what other countries are there? Egypt definitely hits it. More than 50 to 60% of the population is under 25 years old. What other countries in the world hit that situation? Mainly African countries, I think.
It's going to
Like
be difficult.
Nigeria. I think also South Africa, maybe.
But across Western nations, I mean, the biggest problem, I know a lot of people choose to actively choose. We don't want children. They don't, because you have a world where you can pretty much do anything in a way that you couldn't 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But a lot of people, in my social circles, kind of in their mid-30s, would like to have children and would like to have more children. And they can't afford it on median wages with the housing costs where they are.
Especially with the
So,
cost of living right now, in the last 3 or 4 years,
well,
it's a funny way to put it though, isn't it? Because in the past, this was this. I'm sorry, but most people didn't think like that.
No, they just had the
You
children, didn't they?
just had the children, and then you got on with it. So it's almost like we've said we're in control of the birth rate, if you like, rather than just. I'm from a family of four. I think you said before, Charles, you're from a big family, no?
12, yeah, 12.
12, like, which is exceptional. It would have been exceptional
It wouldn't have
30.
been 100 years ago, right?
No, it wouldn't, but 30 years ago, flip me, it would have been very exceptional.
It's just a walk in the park. He's apparently fathered 14 children, so
That we know of.
that we know of, exactly. I mean, this guy's just, I think he's a big proponent of it, but. Yeah, no, I've got a smallish family, got a sister, but let's have a look and let's move on to V-Day 8, obviously held on Thursday, 8th of May 2025, marking the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe. Commemorations across the UK included a national service at Westminster Abbey, attended by King Charles III, senior royals, Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and veterans. The day featured a national 2-minute silence, military parades, fly past, beacon lightings, and community events like street parties and concerts, honouring the sacrifices of the wartime generation and celebrating 8 decades of peace. So, did anyone everyone observe the silence. I mean, it was a phenomenal display. There was a concert as well in the evening that they hosted in front of Buckingham Palace with the King Charles in attendance. But what do you make of it? Can you imagine growing up in the war and having the celebration, like going out in 1945 on the 8th of May and just everything falling silent, and then an announcement on the BBC, and then, the famous speech by Churchill, and then the probably one of the biggest parties that London and the UK has ever seen.
Yeah, I don't think anyone, if you weren't there, and there's still quite a few people, especially, people who were children back then, like my grandfather, who were there as children, and I don't think you can imagine it, really, 6 years of total war coming to an end. And now it's kind of interesting because obviously Victory Day back, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s was kind of about sort of defeating Germany, and now it's more about peace in Europe, I would say.
Do you think we've forgotten? Do you think we've forgotten a lot since Second World War? There's a lot of things, lessons that maybe, as the question I've got is this going to dilute out to the point where, the younger generations are going to forget that as obviously a lot of the veterans die out and pass away, people who were not around in the war. And
Well, who?
let's face it, there's a lot of 100-year-olds and centenarians who were around at the time, but that those numbers every year are
They're
going
dwindling.
dwindling down, And like the funny thing is, the missus was in the supermarket at the time yesterday when it happened at midday, and she said she stopped, they observed the silence, but a lot of the older gens were the ones who were just carrying on, ignored it, doing the shopping. And you're thinking, wait a minute, is that because they grew up in that era? They're kind of like the boomer generation who
Well,
didn't want the, they're just kind of like, they almost made sacrifices because of the war, and they just don't want to forget it.
don't know, or if you're a boomer in your 60s, the war was kind of like a distant memory when you were born, like the times have been on. It's
It
2025, the
was,
war
but I
ended in
still think that they saw
1945,
things like my dad saw
like
things like
rationing.
rationing books, and I mean, the 70s was still a period where Britain was rebuilding. There was a lot of, a decline in the economy, and I do wonder whether they felt a bit bitter about that.
Well, I don't
I think
know.
it's more likely that the Brits senile and they didn't remember that it was, and therefore they just,
Possibly,
what, and the big announcement on the tannoy saying we will be announcing a
they've
2 minute
gone
silence.
shop, they've gone shopping, and they're not worried about it.
Well,
I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that as a population in most Western countries, that we don't think that bad crap can happen again, and it can.
I
You
think,
know,
yeah, it's sort of.
I was back from Lebanon, and I went and saw some of the bombing that had happened by the Israelis in Lebanon, and Lebanon's a fairly nice place, fairly westernized in lots of ways. And there's a building in right in the center of hundreds of buildings, and a missile has come in and taken out just two floors. The whole building is still standing, and a missile's come in and taken out two floors. That's how accurate those missiles are now. And basically, this was from the opposition, if you like, and they just took them out. So it can happen. So I think we as Westerners think that we live in a completely peaceful world, and it doesn't happen because it doesn't touch us.
Well, it's kind of like the lessons of preparedness, I think, is the most scary thing in terms of UK doesn't make enough food to feed itself. Now, this is a huge problem. Can we ramp up to make enough food to feed ourselves in like an actual war situation? Probably. But actually, we don't have it. Or, for example, our steelworks. The idea of not being able to make our own steel in a war is madness. It's basically it's insurance is basically what it is. You have to be able to make your own steel. The fact that our Royal Navy has just been completely gutted, or we have our armed forces are just completely underfunded. And basically, I mean, the big thing is that if you spend some money now making sure you're prepared for a war situation, if a war does come, it's significantly cheaper and you're a lot more prepared. And basically, like the number one role of a nation state's government is the defense of the realm, and people seem to have forgotten that. It
Yes,
literally is more important than education, than health, than pensions, anything.
and I think it's safer to say we are probably closer to war now in the last 80, we aren't right now than we have been in the last 80 years since the end of Second World War. But what I would say is the on my only thing point would be, we are the if there is a world war or some sort of war, it is very going to look very different to any previous wars. You know, in terms of land, it'll be settled and fought. You know, I don't want to mention too much dwell on nuclear, but that's the reality. I can't see it being a land war of NATO troops. You know, I know there's been f bordering on Estonia and trying to do a lot of kind of almost like saber rattling, isn't it, on the sidelines? But you know, do you think that it would look very differently now than any other
But
previous war?
I said it a few weeks ago, I think, on the roof that I said, I think we've just gone into World War III, but it's an economic war.
Economic, yeah.
And Trump has basically said, here's all the tariffs, I'm throwing the gauntlet down. And he's been rowing back ever since the day he announced it. You know, he realized that, this was a very bad play. And I don't care what anybody says, it was a very, very bad play. He can try and save face as we go through this situation, but this was not the way to negotiate good deals for America.
No, it
No.
wasn't. But it's the fact that the key negotiating point the US wants to have with China in their talks, whether they happen or not, is rare earth elements. You know, it's now being reported on widely because without that rare earth element processing, the US defense industry has real problems. I think Trump's kind of like his sort of art of the deal, his negotiations. He doesn't really know what he's doing. But I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've talked enough there. Put the world to rights. Let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. I've got Symphony Environmental Technologies, SYM, shares soaring 123% following the announcement of a funding round completed at a premium, signaling strong investor confidence. Big Technologies climbed 28% after a management shakeup, including the appointment of a new CEO, CFO, alongside an 11% year-over-year increase in Q1 revenues. Mosman Oil and Gas, MSMN, gained 63% due to positive volume estimates at the Colorado project, extending its recent upward momentum. And then Surface Transforms, SCE, experienced a 40% rise, likely driven by notable director share purchases and subsequent announcements. EML, one you've mentioned, Charles, in the past, Emerson, up 20%. Give us your thoughts on any movement in that share price.
What, on Emerson?
Yeah.
Or yeah, well, basically we had an RNS just at the tail end of last month request for arbitration. Not tail end, actually it was on the 1st of May, sorry. Basically, Emerson's now broadened its claim for full compensation for its potash project, which was internally valued at $2.2 billion. They're fully funded for litigation, and they expect that the arbitration process is going to take a couple of years. If it comes out in their favor, then you know, $2.2 billion in their market cap is, you know, even now what, nothing? What is it? 30 million? 40 million?
Yeah.
I don't even know. I mean, this, it's £30 million, $2.2 billion potential, you know, legal win. And given who they're being represented by, I think they probably will win. You'll have to wait a couple of years, you know, to get that win and then get the money out of them. This was my moonshot at the start of the year, and we sold it out at 0.73, and now it's 2.24. So hopefully it keeps rising and rising. We get up to the 10p by the end of the year, but I
There's
guess
quite
we'll
a
see.
lot of these that sort of litigation ones, isn't there, that have been written about in the past
Well,
where there's
there's GreenX, there's Zenith, there's quite a few.
Kazera Global, didn't they get one?
Kazera, yeah. I think it's kind of interesting because I'll, do you know what, I'll tell you what it is. I've realized what it is over the past couple of years, is that governments would just take, if you found something really promising, governments would just take it off you, right? And then because the sector was so downtrodden, there's not really much you could do. Now critical minerals are at the center of, you know, global geopolitical debate. Suddenly law firms are springing up and going, hang on, if we fund this for sort of $20 million, we might be able to get, you know, 300-400 million out of it. So it's as simple as that, really. It's the fact the assets are now worth significantly more. It's worth the law firms going after them. And if you've got the right, you know, law firm like Boies Schiller, for example, good chance you're going to win.
Tiger Royalties, TIR, were up 20% on a letter of intent to invest 250,000 in Tao Strategies Singapore, marking its entry into the decentralized AI sector. What do you make of that? I know we've talked before with Jonathan Bixby about this Arok VC and this kind of intelligent AI method at which they can look at these meme coins and certain coins and buy in and get in before the rise and any trends. So do you like that sort of thing? Do you think there's money to be made on these meme coins?
There's always money to be made on meme coins. It's whether the strategy actually works or not, whether that technology works or not. And honestly, if you don't have access to the source code, you can't know. That's you know, the be all end of it. If it does work, they're going to make a load of money. And if it doesn't work, then they're wasting a lot of money. But we literally, we can't know, can we?
No, absolutely. Conroy Gold, the good old Conroy, that they announced on Friday that they discovered antimony bearing float samples from the Clontibret gold deposit area in County Monaghan Island. So what do we make of that? Did we expect an announcement on that, the effectively pathfinder mineral there?
We always, before antimony went, hectic because of the Chinese export controls, they've been talking about antimony on those licenses forever, haven't they? They've always had antimony and gold. So were we expecting that specific announcement? No. Did we know they were set, doing rescaling, researching for antimony on the licenses? Yes. Obviously, it's good news. But basically, we have to wait and see what the plans are for the follow-up actions. But I mean, this is the same with a lot of companies at the moment. Antimony is obviously floating at record highs. It's really popular. It's attractive to funders. And I think more importantly than that is there's one line kind of buried in the middle of the RNS. The company also intends to apply to the European Commission for recognition of Clontibret as a strategic project under the European Critical Raw Minerals Materials Act 2024 on the basis of the antimony content. Now, when the original European Union projects were announced a couple of months ago, some of them went up 100, 200% on the day. You've got Conroy. I know Conroy is massively beaten down and massively sold off. But if they do apply and they do get accepted, in the next quarter or two, I think it's quite reasonable to see it do having like a big pop of a day. I think that's probably the most important takeaway. It's the same along the same lines as Greenrock, Blencow, Hermina, and a few others. But the difference is obviously that those others are outside of the European Union. This one is in Ireland, inside of the European Union. So it's more likely to be decided quicker.
So would there be some sort of potential for grant funding offered?
Grant funding, loans. I think possibly most importantly, because you're in Ireland where it's kind of difficult to build and deliver a mine, it's the fact you'll get streamlined permitting, which is probably more important, and then loans and everything else. But I think the bigger thing is once you stamp it with that sort of stamp of approval, getting a partner to come and assess the asset on their dime is going to be a hell of a lot easier than it is currently.
Yeah, I mean the antimony side of things was there when we went a few years ago, wasn't it? There was an old antimony mine, Clontibret anyway. But this is quite interesting because this is a trial pit northeast of the Tullybuck and Liscannor mines. It returned high gold grades of 21.9 grams per ton and 11.2 grams per ton gold. Now that was with XRF, but take that with a pinch of salt, but I mean, certainly much higher than the 2% of the 517,000 ounces of gold, which is at Clontibret that's already been jorked. But the antimony content was above 40%. Like, wow, that has got to be like a rock that's 40% antimony is like, oh, okay, here we go. So Clontibret is fully owned by Conroy Gold. The
So
land.
is this an antimony mine with a gold credit, or is it a gold mine with an antimony credit?
Well, I mean, you gotta look at it from the perspective of we've had this discussion with lots of other companies before. How much is 517 ounces of gold, 2 grams per ton, that is near surface in an open pit? How much?
517,000 ounces, yeah.
Sorry, 517,000. How much is that worth? Okay, now you can say it's worth. $100 an ounce, you can say it's worth, $10 an ounce, you can say whatever. But the fact of the matter is, right now, Conroy Gold as a whole, with all of these different assets, is worth about £1.3 million as a company. So when you say if suddenly grants were to come from the European Union for the antimony or whatever, this isn't just going to bounce 100%, this is going to go bananas,
That's the dream. Yeah.
And back to 20, 30, 40, 50p in a heartbeat, in my view, because people are then going to start to realize, oh my goodness, this is a resource. And I still say that in terms of ounces in the ground, it would, if available to be proven, Conroy will be as big as Greatland Gold in terms of Havieron, if not bigger.
A bold statement,
No,
Colin.
but
If
I
it
think
pays
it's
off.
true. I think it's true because both Clontibret and Clay Lake, having visited them, the comment now is that it's more and more and more likely that they are connected. And if they are, you've got literally, miles, kilometers of strike and, 1 to 2% gold.
Well, the advantage that you have of a gold antimony mine is that when you find gold and antimony together, you generally find large amounts of both because they happen to attract each other. So you've got the Olympiada gold mine in Russia, which is the world's largest antimony mine, but it's, and also a significant producer of gold. But then also, you've got the Xinguangshan mine in China, in the Hunan province. But also, others that people will know, the Stibnite Gold Project that's in Idaho, or the Hillgrove Project in Australia. And basically wherever you find large amounts of antimony and gold, you're gonna find a lot together. But with Corduroy, it's a case of they're doing this reassessment of current data and they're gonna have to go drilling again. So they need to attract a partner. And basically, bottom line for me is get the strategic status from the European Union, and then that becomes a lot more feasible. And that's
They
the way they
also
get it
need
done.
they also need to test Clontibret at depth because it remains untested, and I think a lot of indicators.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is they need a partner, and they know that themselves. And I think it's going to come, before the end of 2025. I'll be shocked if they don't have a partner. I think there's a lot of people in the, when I spoke to Cackle, there's a lot of people in the data room. I mean, he's not shy to tell me that there are people in the data room, and I don't think that's inside information. That's just people looking at what the project is about. So yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah, and then talking of joint venture, that Alien Metals announced a partner, joint venture partner for the drill contract awarded for Elizabeth Hill, and also technical visit completed to define drill targets. I know it's one you've mentioned in the past, Alien Metals UFO, the ticker, Charles, just give us an update on that.
Yeah, so Alien Metals vended in their Elizabeth Hill silver project into Errawarra. That's going to be renamed West Coast Silver. And they're planning on drilling within the next 2 or 3 weeks at Elizabeth Hill. And they're funded for this drilling. So for context, Elizabeth Hill used to be the highest grade silver mine in Australia. And there's very few pure play silver projects on the ASX. So basically, you're hoping you get one high grade silver hit back from this drilling. Those shares rocket ahead and then everything's gravy. But the Elizabeth Hill silver asset, it genuinely is probably one of the best assets in Australia to be drilling for. And it's funded, and we're crossing our fingers, basically, and that's all drilling is until the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Let the truth machine do the talking,
Let
as
the
it were.
truth machine do the
Yeah,
talking,
I
yeah.
mean, so silver's now currently, as we record, at 34.58, roughly 34.5, and gold's at 33.05, roughly. Gold silver ratio at that those price points is 95.6, which is obviously historical of around 60, suggesting silver is undervalued. And if we look at that now, I mean, do we think that the all-time high for silver, if we look at it and adjusted for inflation, is around $68, which was a 2011 high of $49. Do we see silver moving back? I know it's always been one a tough one to call, but are we looking at $50 silver? Do we think about that, or are we starting point around the $68, $70 silver?
Well, is silver a base metal like copper, because that's what it's been trading like for a long time? Or is it a precious metal that is out of its lockstep with gold and will recover to its lockstep with gold? I think you can find 100 analysts and 50 will say one, 50 will say the other. Will gold come down a bit and roll and silver rise a little bit, potentially? But then you also have major banks now saying $4,000 or $5,000 gold is completely feasible in the next year or two. I do think if you get to a point where gold rises to $4,000, then silver will have to come to meet it a little bit, simply because there'll be a lot of people sitting on $4,000, $5,000 an ounce of gold who just think, right, I can sell my 1 ounce of gold, 1 out of 10, say, and buy this massive stack of silver as a hedge. Do you know? I think that would just create a lot of buying, and gold keeps going to
And I
new record
think, as
highs.
Kev mentioned, going up, it's all very good if you want to trade a bit of gold, or gold becomes a currency, but you can't just shave a bit off your 1 kilo.
No, it's like when
You
the
can actually spend a coin. I mean, argent, the Latin word for argent, for silver, is, watch, it means money or currency. So actually, it's the oldest currency as we know it.
Well, your salary comes from Latin words, for
Yeah,
salt.
salt, yeah.
Salt's probably not as valuable as gold anymore, sadly, or silver. But I think it was funny when we had the massive power cut across, Spain, Portugal, parts of France, lots of Western Europe. And people saying, oh, your card doesn't work. You can't buy things in the shop because your card, and you can't use cash because the tills aren't working, and you can't use Bitcoin because electricity is down. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, that's true, but also I doubt anyone walked into their local Mercadona, with an ounce of gold and started shaving off pieces for their bread.
That
So
level.
You know, it's I think it's the thing though, when you're talking about stacking silver or gold, like I've bought gold a little bit, you know, every month for pretty much my whole adult life, and a little bit of silver as well. And I don't really look at the price because it's more a hedge against total financial collapse.
Yes.
And yeah, it's funny because, you know, if I just bought gold and not done anything with stocks, I'd probably be better, financially better off than investing in any companies at this moment in time, which is also a bit mad, but it's probably
Yeah,
true for
well,
all
if
of
you
us.
look at gold's performance, it's outperformed S&P, hasn't it, over the last probably 5, 10 years?
25.
Oh, okay, 25 years.
Yeah.
I think my view is that silver cannot keep lagging gold in to this extent. I think every time in history that silver has lagged gold to this extent,
Shot up at
it
some
has
point,
shot
yeah.
up. You know, when that will be, who knows? But
And that's the problem, isn't it? It's that opportunity cost. Is it going to be tomorrow or 5 years from now, Kev?
yeah, I don't think it's going to be 5 years from now. If you look at the long-term chart on silver, it looks primed to go in the next year or two.
Is there a big silver stack on the bookshelves behind your head that we can't see?
No, but I'm buying some silver every month. You know,
Yeah.
there's no VAT on silver here, so you can buy silver. What I can tell you for a fact is 3 to 4 months ago, I was buying maybe a kilogram of silver, which sounds very fancy, but effectively, what that's about 900 quid or 850 quid. And normally, it was delivered the next day. Okay, I collect it. The last month, I bought 1.5 kilos, and he's told me it's 2 to 4 weeks delivery. Why? He said because there's some huge orders going in. Effectively, I can take one of my gold ounces and now go and buy close to, I think it's 3 kilograms of silver. You know, so how long or how much will it take for, you know, a few people to turn around and
Well, I was
say,
saying,
well,
yeah.
these 3 or 4 gold coins, let's go and get, you know, let's go and get 12 kilograms of silver, you know, and all of a sudden, there's not going to be enough silver,
And
physical silver.
have you seen the cost? I mean, it's not a true indication, because if you actually look at like silver bullion now on the Royal Mint, and you want to buy like a silver Britannia or even a Canadian maple leaf, you're looking at like £40 per coin easily. Do you know what I mean? It's not $33 when you look at the actual coin cost, because
Yeah,
obviously they
but yeah, the Royal Mint is a little bit squiffy though, Phil, because gold is VAT and capital gains free, and I'm not sure. I think silver isn't. So
Silver
like that,
isn't, you have to pay
yeah.
VAT.
So
You
they're
still have to
like,
pay VAT on that. So if it's £40, you're paying 48 quid in the UK for it.
yeah. But it's the Royal Mint stuff is just all completely all over the place because of the
Yeah,
tax
but
regime.
even Charles, if you go to Bullion, it's silver to go, and Bullion,
Yeah.
like Bullion by post, they're all the same. They're all in the 40 quid mark.
Well, it's funny because the silver price and the gold price in China for actually buying physical gold is higher, a lot higher than the spot price. And if you want to buy like a 1 ounce gold bar from Costco in America, it's all, you know, we can probably look it up now. Actually, hang on 2 seconds. Costco 1 ounce gold.
The Britannia's, if I'm on just on the Royal Mint now, the Britannia 2025 1 ounce silver is 32.50. Add on your VAT 6.51, you're looking at £39.08, and then you've got your shipping fee on there on top of it. So you're not going to get a coin under 40 quid. And then gold is trading at the Britannia 2025 1 ounce is coming in at £2,663.92 if you order one, and then a slight reduction for two coins. So already there, you're looking at about 2,700 shipped.
But
Yeah.
that is the gold price. The gold, when you buy it in the UK, is pretty much the gold price. But silver's different because of the VAT
Yeah,
that's
you got VAT
added.
on it. And
And
but don't forget, it's capital gains tax free though, so there's an advantage of it if you've been buying it at the 500 mark.
yeah, but even if you can buy the silver VAT free, you're paying £32. It's
Yeah.
quoted on the markets as $33,
Yeah.
which is just the wrong price.
The wrong
I
price, yeah.
mean, the price, even here in Egypt, when the price started to change in the last couple of months, the price has gone up. And I'm saying, no, but the price of silver is only 32 or 33. And they're saying, well, it's not the price here,
Well,
you know?
your problem is, right, that if gold goes to like 5, 6 thousand, or silver goes to like 70, $80, and you want to realize your gains and get your sort of, because Because the problem is it's always measured in dollars or pounds or like whatever fiat
Right.
currency. So, okay, you can sell it for the currency, which is now becoming more and more worthless. Is that really worth doing? Because then you have to get rid of them quickly to buy something else.
Yeah, one's a paper price and one's a physical, and there's always going to be a
Yeah.
disparity between the two. That's a reality. You've got comics
Well,
issue.
the big problem you have in America with the comic system, and it's the same everywhere around the world now, is that there's roughly 100 times as many contracts for physical gold as there is the actual physical gold in existence. So generally, everyone's just trading with each other, trading against the price. But more and more now, people that want to take physical delivery of their gold contracts. So what happens when there's no more gold left over for the physical deliveries? The price of gold is going to absolutely skyrocket. But whether that will actually happen, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, you talked a minute ago, Charles, about Spain and Portugal. So I just want to come on to that because obviously there's big power issues, and a company had an announcement earlier this week, was Mast Energy Developments. They completed a £5 million definitive investment agreement with Powertree for the fully funded construction of a 7.5 megawatt Hindlip project, and with work expected to start shortly, and then the commissioning targeted within 9 to 12 months. We obviously caught up with Peter Krugel in the week from CEO of Mast Energy Developments to talk about that. Let's have a listen to what he had to say. So we just saw news that Mast has completed a £5 million investment agreement with Powertree, securing full funding for its 7.5 megawatt Hindlip project, which will now move into construction with commissioning expected within 9 to 12 months. This marks the start of a long-term growth capital partnership with further projects anticipated. Trading revenues at MED's Pybridge site continue to rise, with February 2025 revenues reaching £77,000 and March preliminaries at £86,000, averaging £24,200 per megawatt per month across the past 9 months. The company also announced a significant reduction in leverage positions held via CFD swaps, with Cantor Fitzgerald cutting its stake from nearly 6% to 0.23%, and Spreadex believed to have fully exited. Peter, you highlighted the strategic importance of MED's flexible power assets and the strength of its evolving financial and operational position. Peter, firstly, congratulations on securing the £5 million investment from Powertree. Can you just walk us through what this means for Hindlip project in terms of timelines, ownership structure, and the broader implications for your growth strategy?
Yes, thank you for that overview, Phil. That's spot on. And yeah, regarding our completion of the Hindlip deal, we announced the signing of that agreement just over a month ago. It was subject to certain conditions, which we've successfully satisfied now, and that deal has completed. So that project is fully funded now, with no further funding obligation from our side. So we're going to move into construction, get that site into production, and that will add to our portfolio of megawatts in production, which is our ultimate strategy, is to grow that as quickly as possible. So, our Hindlip site being our first deal with Powertree is a step forward. We're already working on a second project with them, which is the basis of the growth capital partnership, and we expect that partnership to grow, and that's part of our strategy. So that's our strategy on the one side, and then we've got the strategy on the other side in partnership with Riverford, where we target existing sites, which we've very successfully proven our Pybridge. That strategy has got certain other benefits, and we think that the two strategies being run concurrently will expedite the process to reach our target megawatts in production as quickly as possible.
So what are your thoughts on that? This £5 million definitive investment agreement with Powertree, Charles?
Yeah, so obviously £5 million, pretty good, But you've got this long-term partnership, to deploy this capital into these flexible power generation projects that is owned, starting with this 7.5 megawatt construction ready Hindlip project. Basically, this money is literally just to be used for the CapEx construction of the project. So it's not for working capital or anything else. It's literally to get the site into full commercial production. And obviously, this is quite exciting for shareholders, obviously. But you've got Peter saying, obviously, I'm not sure what was just discussed. But we've got this investment agreement with Powertree. It formalizes the growth capital partnership. And it sees the project fully funded with no further funding obligation. We're going to start the construction shortly. And basically, it's the same story almost with Energy Pathways, which guys you may or may not know, which is that you need energy storage. It's as
Yeah.
simple as that, really. We've got this kind of situation in the UK in particular. I mean, our energy storage is worse than anywhere else. And it's almost, I think, one of the key problems is that the larger companies want the government to pay for the building and the maintenance of storage. And the government wants the companies to pay for that because they're generating profits. And those companies are saying, well, you cap our profits. So it's all very well. And yet, it's funny because when Russia even invaded Ukraine and the energy prices skyrocketed and we were kind of, there were worries that we're going to be blackouts, you were thinking, okay, that would be enough to get governments to realize we need more energy storage. And it wasn't. And now you've had proper blackouts across Western Europe. This is Western Europe. This is not, Africa. This is Western Europe. You've had energy blackouts, and it's still not enough. But at some point, somebody is going to have to fund these things. And then this is where you've got smaller companies who are jumping in and saying, right, we'll build the energy storage. And then when you need it, we're going to make a massive profit selling it to someone bigger. And this is probably where they are.
And what about, obviously, we looked at Pybridge and we've seen the revenue there in February at £77,000 with embedded benefits included, and then the March preliminaries were showing 86,000. So the average monthly revenue per megawatt from July 24 to March 25 stands at around 24,200. What do you make of that in terms of the revenues coming in for Pybridge? Obviously, they've got the two engines on site there. They're trying to bring the third one online. But do you think this has got potential to grow out and scale out to become quite a big revenue generating, profitable company?
It's almost a pilot plant, right? It's basically what it is. It's saying, does the model work? Can we generate profit? And the answer is, most likely, yes, we can. We can generate revenue, we can generate profit. Can we scale this out? Can we attract more funding? Yeah, I reckon it's doable. I think it's something that could be really popular, make them a lot of money. At the same time, it's worth mentioning. It's, at the moment, it's not particularly much cash, but that's not the point of it. The point of it is to prove the model, which, is working.
Some of the decliners of the week are Gentex. The stock plummeted 93% following the resumption of trading after a suspension, with the company securing emergency funding and undergoing significant board changes. And then also one Spatial, one SP shares fell 12% to 44.75 after reporting a 79% drop in annual pre-tax profit attributed to slower procurement cycles, particularly in the US. I don't know if you saw a statement from the Fed. They obviously kept interest rates steady around the 4.25 to 4.5% for the third consecutive meeting, citing concerns over inflation and unemployment amid uncertainties from recent tariff implementations. Did you expect that, Charles, from the Fed to keep the interest rate steady?
Well, I expected the UK would cut a 0.25%. And it's interesting that two of our, our Bank of England governors, can't remember, the committee voted for a 0.5% cut. And we're talking, major banks are talking now about interest rates dropping below 3% in a year or so in the UK. In the US, Powell's got a difficult job on his hands because the employment is still very strong. And the tariff situation is two-pronged. The first is that you don't know what the tariffs are going to be 3, 6, 9 months from now. So doing nothing is probably better than doing something. And the second thing is that when you look at tariffs in general, tariffs cause inflation, right? Because when you put tariffs on products, it causes products to become more expensive, so you get more inflation. But tariffs also reduce economic activity, so it reduces growth. Now, interest rates are the lever. If you want to cut, if you have lower growth, the general idea is you cut interest rates to stimulate growth. If you have more inflation, you increase interest rates to reduce the inflation. But tariffs are both inflationary and anti-growth. So doing nothing is probably the best action. And yet the US will probably just slide into stagnation, which is what is really important. The federal, Trump appointed Powell back in the day, and he's calling him a fool on social media. But actually, the reality is that if you cut interest rates in the US, you risk runaway inflation. And if you increase interest rates, you risk destroying economic growth. So he
Meanwhile,
doesn't know
Mr.
what to
Trump's
do.
jumping up and down, going, "God,
Cut them, but
I
it's he
want
doesn't know.
bailouts on the
Jay Powell
banks.
is
Cut
Jay Powell.
bailouts."
This is Jay Powell saying, "Up yours, Trump. I'm
Wow,
not
did you
backing
see
in."
that video back like 5, 6 months ago where like Trump was already threatening to fire Powell and Powell just went, not legal under the law? And the reporter was like, what is it? Not permitted under the law. And it's just, I tell you what it is. I think Trump is jealous of him more than anything else. Because the one thing that Trump wants and has never really had, despite all the votes, is respect. People do laugh at him quite a lot. I don't think anyone's ever properly laughed at Powell. Even if you disagree with his policy decisions, he feels like a grown-up in the room. And Trump just
Well, he
feels
is the
like a
grown up
whiny
in the room,
child.
isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
When you compare him, Trump and Vance, You know, when you go in there, what is it? It's a tag team that's going to try and bully you into doing what they want you to do. That's the deal. There's no
Got to
diplomacy
say
involved.
thank you within 30 seconds of being
Oh God,
approached.
it's I tell you what it feels like, right? Because if you have Powell, Trump, and Vance in the room, it would feel like Powell is like an angry headmaster, and Trump and bloody JD Vance are kind of like school children that have done something wrong. And I'll tell you this
Trump's
as a
the prefect and
speculation.
Vance is the little
Yeah, but
boy.
Carney didn't take any prisoners, did he? He didn't
No,
like
he ripped them
bite to
apart.
him, did he? He was like, I'm not biting about the 51st state and all that lot. He
And
was like,
what was
well, it's
my
not for
cut?
sale.
And then Carney, previous governor of the Bank of England. So maybe that, you need a bit of a spine to do these jobs. But I think my genuine opinion is if Trump were to fire Powell before the end of his term in 2026, then that would cause a real US market crash because Powell is, the glue that's holding it together. And the other thing, more longer term, is when Powell does leave in 2026, which is only, a year away, Trump will install a puppet and then you might see real problems with US monetary policy.
But the likelihood is, and I mean, maybe I'm misreading this economically, but the likelihood is that the amount of inflation that's going to come from the tariffs is going to be much more of a tsunami than the lack of growth. So in essence, you should be thinking, well, interest rates in the US should go up.
Well, maybe. Well, this is the thing, right? Because the ports are empty. I mean, you're starting to see pictures coming through now. Like the activity is dying with containers that's not leaving China. And yet they could do a deal over the weekend. And then on Sunday, when this goes out, this is all kind of irrelevant. But assuming that, even if you do a deal, it'll take months and months to sort through it all. And the basic problem you have is trying to negotiate what effect tariffs will have on inflation in the modern world. Because, for example, you say, okay, well, this pair of Nike shoes are now, 100% more expensive than they were. Is that inflation, or will American consumers just not buy them? That's the question. Because you get to a point where the pricing of things is just so high, they don't actually affect household budgets because people just don't buy those things anymore. So unless they're actual basics, as in like food, shelter, they'll just get ignored. You just have a lower quality of life in America.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's almost like comparing the two nations, America and China, and it's like America are the guys that have no emergency fund whatsoever and are on payday loans, you know, whereas the Chinese have big emergency fund, can probably last a lot longer than the Americans can,
Well,
and that's the comparison.
it's also cultural, isn't it? Because, the US citizens will start whining very quickly when things get very more expensive. The
That's right.
Chinese, A, you've got a communist country that will, throw you in prison if you dare complain.
That's
And
right.
B,
They'll throw you in prison if they like you. If they
well,
don't
it's also
like you, it's something
exactly.
enough.
I think, but it's for national pride, like JD Vance insulting them as Chinese peasants. They haven't forgotten that, in the UK, we can just take a, stiff upper lip. In China, they'll go, okay, we've been insulted. We're happy to stick this out for as long as you are. So I guess it was going to be super fun or, very terrifying for
Well,
us.
I
So.
also don't think that China are going to come to the negotiation table too quickly. I mean, they don't want the pain, but they're also not going to be bullied into something that is very negative for them.
No. And the other problem is that even if you do come to the negotiating table, and even if you do figure it out, and even if you take months and months working it out, and then it goes through Congress and then whatever else, free trade deals, I mean, the US negotiated a free trade deal, the North American free trade area with Mexico and Canada back in 2020, top of my head. And that was meant to last forever. And then Trump had ripped the rule book up. So how can you negotiate? It's the same with Russia and Ukraine, in that you negotiate a peace deal. How can you be sure Putin will, keep that peace? Or Israel and Gaza. Can you be sure Israel will keep the peace or Gaza will keep the peace?
Well, Israel haven't, have they?
No,
They've
but it
said.
doesn't matter. But the point, it doesn't matter, does it? When you're talking about these trade deals, US and China does a trade deal. How can China be sure that the US just won't renege in a year or two? Or even next week when Trump just, does a
Yeah.
line of cocaine and decides to
Has
change
a
his mind?
bad hair day.
Well,
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, the scenario is, and this is the point I was trying to make, who. If you're in the country that needs payday loans, which is basically what they do every time they print, okay, then who is in a worse position to negotiate when you've got China, who've got the other 6.5 billion people to sell to, and the 380 million Americans they don't sell to? You know, they're going to find alternative markets because there are alternative markets. And the rest of the world actually might become slightly deflationary because there's going to be a lot of goods that need to go somewhere that are going to be cheaper.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I mean, it's kind of like when we talk about like the UK trade deal, it could, you know, I'm not saying this will happen because things change so quickly, but if you have the lowest tariffs, you know, exporting into America of anywhere on earth, then suddenly you've got, you know, the best place to export from is the UK. And then you also have Chinese goods coming to the UK that were previously going to go to the US because, you know, sharing is the same language, which are cheaper now because it's, you know, you can sell them much cheaper into the UK than you can into the US. Even if the tariffs get down to 50%, you might find a massive import-export increase in the economy that jumpstarts our GDP. But obviously trying to predict these global events is just
what's
nightmarish.
This made in China, designed in UK and delivered by the UK?
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. Okay. So let's have a look at some of the sports news. I mean, the 2025 Miami Grand Prix, that was certainly for me, was the best race we've seen thus far in the F1 season. McLaren's Oscar Piastri securing his third consecutive victory, outmaneuvering teammate, obviously, Lando Norris and George Russell, who claimed third, while pole sitter Max Verstappen struggled to fourth, hampered by Red Bull's lackluster race pace. So I don't know if anyone saw it. I know, Kev, we talked about it, but I thought it was an outstanding race. Obviously, there was all sorts of strategy woes at Ferrari with Hamilton there, you know, fiery radio exchanges as Leclerc was in front. Then obviously, you know, Hamilton went ahead, and then Hamilton was told that Leclerc must pass him because of the different tyres configuration and medium.
And then the
and
radio
hard.
Said to him someone was behind him, and he said, do you want me to let them through as well?
He did, didn't he?
Every time you've mentioned the Grand Prix in the last two or three podcasts, it's been stony silence from me and Charles because we don't watch it. But I made a point of watching this one, and it was a very good race, yes. But it's been interesting weekends, isn't it? And also, football's been big. Arsenal had the Champions League during the week. Arteta was the best team lost, Mr. Arteta.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the best team lost because PSG were pretty convincing, I'd say.
Well,
but
I think the best team is the one that scores the most goals and everything else is chat for the pub.
Yeah,
sorry.
And that's what the PSG manager said, wasn't it? He was like, well, I think the idea of football is you score goals.
Do you know, it's like when you have a striker who's just amazing but just won't shoot, and you just sort of like just shoot the ball, because if you don't, it's not going to go in the net.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like a 5-year-old understands that more than these professionals sometimes. It drives me insane.
And then we have an
all England final,
incredible
England
situation
League.
Now where we have 15th and 16th in the Premier League fighting for a Champions League
dismal,
in the
absolutely
Europa League
dismal
final. Unbelievable.
Season. Yeah, so the dismal domestic season of United and Spurs, as you say, 15th and 16th in the Premier League, and now fighting out for a final, which is on May the 21st in Bilbao, San Mamés Stadium. I don't know if you saw the game, Kev. I mean, Mason Mount, I mean, I've never seen the guy play like that before. I don't know where he pulled that out of, but he certainly pulled it out of the bag, and I thought it was an outstanding performance last night.
He's
despite
25% more increase in his salary if they get the Champions League.
Yeah, they're all fighting out. The winner will claim that, obviously, not only the silverware, as Kev says, but they're also the coveted 2025-26 Champions League spot. Who's going to win, do we think?
You know, the big team normally in these occasions is normally United. But for sure, I won't come on you Spurs. But that's only me. But so that doesn't really give an answer. I think
United, because I've thought from the outset that they've just, the way they've come back, their performances it's like watching a different team. I genuinely don't understand how they can be so dismal in the domestic league, but then go and put on the performances that they've done in the Europa. It doesn't make sense.
Well, I think if you have like a really bad, if you have a bad season and you know you're just going to finish outside of the top 10 regardless.
Yeah.
You then go on to like play a different game, a different, you know, whether it's Champions League, whatever, you're going to have fresh energy, aren't you? You just are.
There's something on the game, whereas the Premier League at the minute, there's nothing on either of them.
No, they just need to avoid relegation and everything else is kind of...
Well, they've avoided relegation, and the best they can finish is probably one or two places higher, if possible.
It doesn't really matter. There's no incentive, is there?
I think that what there is a lot more incentive for Manchester United to win than there is Spurs. I was reading an article about Casemiro. Casemiro's contract, he receives a further 25% increase in his wages to over £500,000 a week if they win a European trophy and are in the Champions League.
Ridiculous. And do you know what annoys me? There are all these layoffs at United and all the penny pinching that has been done under Radcliffe. It's just bonkers that they're paying those wages
Yeah,
just
but
for that, just for the
those
Europa
contracts
League.
are there, aren't they? It's
Yeah,
crazy.
absolutely. No, I'm not disputing it, but it just seems
Whoever
so.
signed those contracts, who signed Casemiro? Was it Mourinho? I don't know who brought him to United,
But
but
it's tricky, though, isn't it? You talk about layoffs and everything, but actually, if you win a trophy, how much does that massively increase, ticket sales or, merchandising sales? How much does that improve your club's finances? It's not always easy,
If United don't win and they're not in Europe next year, then you're going to massively affect how people buy the Manchester United shirt and
agreed.
how people, I know for sure Liverpool's shirt sales are going to be through the roof in the next 12 months because we're champions and affects many factors in the club. And I mean, I don't know Manchester United. I think I've because of the Glazers have basically paid out billions literally over the last 15 years, however many years it is now, out of the club to the Glazers. And until they get rid of the Glazers and that drain stops, even being one of the biggest clubs in the world, it's not going to make any difference because
Needs a massive shake-up for
they're
sure.
just being drained.
But then on the other hand, United is just outside of the UK. I don't know if you guys have ever felt this, but like Manchester United is almost like a cultural export, beyond Arsenal or Liverpool or anybody else. When you say English football, Manchester United just goes straight to the head of someone who's never been to the UK. So it's a cultural export as well. Let's hope they sort their finances out and everything will be fine.
Absolutely. Okay, anything else? Anything else looking forward to in the next week or two?
No, just enjoying the weather, to
We've
be
got the
honest.
US Open coming up, the US Open Golf, and
Yeah.
that'll be next weekend coming in Hollow Quail, I think it is in America. So that should be interesting because
Next Formula One race is on the 18th of May at Imola. So it's a home race for Ferrari and Kimi Antonelli. I wonder if they'll do something. It'd be nice to see Ferrari actually win some races, but it looks like Hamilton's struggling with that car, with it just turn in and the understeer on it. So it'll be interesting to see whether he does finally get some podium finishes. But if you like what
it's
you've
not
heard,
the Open, it's the PGA. Sorry, I got it wrong.
well, if you like what you heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for further notifications of future episodes, and have a great weekend all and enjoy the weather.
Yeah, I think the weather's caused the fact that the markets have been particularly boring this week because there's been very little action on our part of the market since Tuesday.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.